This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, grassroots organizations in Baltimore struggle to build a movement for social change. Hundreds of thousands of Haitians face deportation from the Dominican Republic, and the United States and its allies step up their campaign to destabilize the East African nation of Eritrea.
But first, the shockwaves of the massacre at Charleston, South Carolina's Emmanuel AME Church continue to reverberate around the nation. We spoke with Kevin Alexander Gray, an activist and writer based in Columbia, South Carolina, which is quite near the home of Dylan Roof, the young white man arrested for the shootings.
Come from across the river, Lexington County, the most conservative Republican county in the state. Headquarters of Maurice Bessinger's Barbecue. Now, Maurice is dead, and they ain't flying the Confederate flag over his barbecue outfit anymore. But if you go out into Pelion and Gaston and Swansea and all those little small towns out in rural Lexington County, I mean, you know, you'll see Confederate flags flying all over the place. And, you know, for the most part, here in South Carolina, a Confederate flag on a car, bump of a car, is just as common as a stop sign. So trying to figure out where he learned, what he learned, saying that black folk can rape the women and take over, that kind of racist talk is as old as the relationship between black folk and white folk in America. That's Turner Diaries, that's Ku Klux Klan, that's trying to fight against Mississippi Nation, that's all of that, and that's not new. So to say, where did he learn this? All he had to do is walk down the street, and the street might happen to be named Confederate Street or Bull Street, named after the general that warned the people about the slave rebellions that were going on in the state. He can drive down Calhoun Street, named after the great nullifier, who was the first one that coined the terms interposition and nullification that Martin Luther King talked about. And so South Carolina is the ideological home of white supremacy in this country. And now with the Southernization of American politics, where everything is right up on top of the table, and most of these politicians and people in power, they may not say the word white supremacy, but that's what it is. And now they got people even confused about the term racism. People think the term racism means that you don't like somebody of another race. Well, that term would be bigotry. Racism is about power and the power that they have to keep us as second-class citizens and keep us in a state of always wondering if we're going to survive. That's what it's about. And that's what the flag's about. And that's what that young kid, whoever put it in his head, was about. To go down to attack the most noted symbol of fighting back in the state of South Carolina, the church founded by Denmark Vesey, to kill people on the day that Denmark Vesey and his compatriots were plotting a slave rebellion, says that he did his research, or someone put that in his head. It's ridiculous. And now the governor called for death penalty, which I'm against, because they want to bury him so they can bury talking about this flag.
And, of course, the Turner Diaries that you referred to called for the instigation of a race war in the country, and that's what this young man was talking to his friends about.
Well, you know, people talk about gun control in this country, and they want to paint the picture that black people are the face of criminality. Well, the majority of guns owned in this country are owned by white people who are taught to be prepared for the coming race war. They might not say it out loud, but they're buying their guns to protect themselves from what they think might happen in the future. They operate on that guilt. They operate on the mindset that if we were treated like black folk were treated, we'd rebel too. And they buy up all the guns, and they defend the Second Amendment. Now, some say it's about rebelling against the government, and I guess for some it is. But for some, they believe that the government exists to take what they got and give it to black folk, the special interest. They come up with all kind of code words to talk about black people. Medicaid, rejecting Medicaid funding. We don't want to give something to undeserving, lazy Negroes. That's what it's all about. Voter fraud. We don't want to let those undeserving Negroes vote, or at least let them start taking tests like we used to have to take literacy tests to figure out how many bubbles in a bar of soap. It's all very sad that this country which is predicated on racism and white supremacy. They celebrate the 4th of July as Independence Day because it's the day after the abolitionists or the people who are against slavery relented and allowed the anti-slavery cause to be taken out of the Constitution. People need to understand their history and understand the nature of this country and fight back against it, fight back against white supremacy being about suppressing black folk here in America, and white supremacy abroad is about American exceptionalism and suppressing people across the water.
President Obama says that this is just a problem of gun control.
Look, this is all about power and the power to inflict fear in people. Now, I don't think that this kid ought to be charged as a terrorist or with hate crimes. He ought to be charged for murder and put in jail for life. Now, if he hates black people so much, well, the jails are disproportionately filled with black people. Send him there. Send him and his parents, whoever's going to come to visit him, let them spend the rest of their lives visiting him in a place where the people that they claim to despise the most, that's who they're going to see. So President Obama has no moral authority to say anything about mass killings when he decides every Tuesday who's going to die and when he's the assassination president, killing people without due process.
Are people in your neighborhood, which is the neighborhood that the perpetrator comes from, on heightened alert?
No, not really. And in fact, if you go to Charleston, tourism goes on in Charleston. Charleston tourism is based on slavery tourism. And now, just like everything else that happens with the media and with our country, you know, now it's terror tourism. Everybody's going by the church. And I don't want to diminish that because there are some people, white people, who are totally ashamed of what happened, and they'll express, and I've heard it expressed to me a lot of times since this incident happened, that they're ashamed to be white people. So there are people who have the consciousness to understand what's going on, and I don't want to diminish that. And they feel soul sick as to what happened in that church. And for those of us that knew Clemente and not to take away from the other souls that were lost, I have worked as a newspaper editor and as a critic and a writer of many people in the legislature. That young brother was legit. And the fact that that young guy could come into his church and sit next to him for the period of time that he sat next to him and be welcomed into that church is a testament to the kind of fellow that he is. So no question, people are grieving. But something has to change. And part of it is that we've got to take on this ideology of white supremacy and what it means.
That was Kevin Alexander Gray, speaking from Columbia, South Carolina.
In Washington, Reverend Anthony Evans heads the National Black Church Initiative, a multi-denominational coalition of black churches around the country. Reverend Evans says black congregations need to beef up their security.
It is no question that this is an assault against the black church and its members. I want to point out very clear evidence that will back this up. First of all, this was a community-based pastor. He was just not a local pastor, but he was a state representative. He was constantly in the news. That's number one. Number two, he spoke out very forcefully and clearly and powerfully against the police officer who was charged with murder of Mr. Walter Scott of the North Charleston Police Department. Number three, he called for body cameras on a state level that all police should have. So he was constantly in the news. So the only thing that Mr. Roof had to do is Google his name and find out who is the church. And then he would have gotten two for the price of one because that was the most historic, oldest church in South Carolina. And so he systematically planned this attack. He knew that he would came on a Sunday, he would have got some resistance. But he came on a Wednesday night, which is prayer meeting and Bible study night, and he blended in a small crowd, sat in the back, and everybody thought that he just came for prayer and understanding the scripture, but he came to murder. Now, the question for us to investigate is that who motivated him to do this? Because we do not believe that he acted on his own, that there are forces within South Carolina and this country that galvanize young white males to do these mass murders. And no one has done the story, Glenn, on the fact that why is it that white males keep doing these atrocities? There is something wrong with their psychology. Connecticut, that white boy killed 23 babies. In Colorado, all of those are white kids who mass murdered on two occasions, who mass murdered, one in the Clinton administration, now under this administration. And also here is another case of point. Why is it that white kids with guns who hate black people under 21 is running around murdering black people in a systematic way? This is an assassination.
And yet President Obama came on national television and he seemed to be saying that this is about gun violence and he made no mention of race.
Well, the president has gotten this wrong from the beginning because he's afraid of race. He's black, but he's afraid of race. Let's go down the situation. He called the looters of the folks who were protesting in Baltimore, particularly the ones who burned the CVS, as thugs. But he didn't call the white kids, the white men, white gang in Colorado, the Midwest, who killed nine, which police gathered over 200 weapons, automatic weapons, AK-47s and others. They confiscated over 200 bikes and arrested over 150 white men. But he didn't say anything about them being a thug, and neither did the president say anything about this young man who murdered innocent black Christians who were praying to Jesus, harmless, that he was a thug. He systematically walked in, assassinated the pastor, and killed everybody else in sight. And he thought he had mercy by sparing the life of one or several black women who they to go out and report what he has done.
And you're preparing to go to South Carolina to direct a number of churches on security measures that they should undertake for their congregants and their families.
Again, the lack of leadership from the administration. This is not the first time that violence has happened in a black church. Violence has gone up in particularly the black church by 700% over the past 10 years and has gone up the same amount of rate in the white church. The administration has never said anything about working with us pastors to mitigate that situation in any way, have shown no leadership skills whatsoever, have been afraid to even touch this issue, and I don't know why. And it seems to me that, again, this administration, this president, gets it wrong every single time when it comes down to race, when it comes down to killing, when it comes down to the church. I'm not sure what to say other than the fact that we continue to pray for our president and we continue to pray for this country, but prayers won't do it this time. We need some action, and that's why I'm going down personally to direct our churches how to harden their church in terms of safety of men, women, and children, and women, to make sure that they can get through a worship series without getting killed. They do not have to worry about this in the white church. We only have to worry about this in the black church. I question why. Why is there no leadership from this administration? The Justice Department is toothless, and they have no power whatsoever. It's the same Justice Department that we suffered under J. Edgar Hoover. This is unbelievable that we're revisiting this type of history all over again.
Sounds like you might be talking about reviving Deacons for Self-Defense, which has a venerable tradition.
Well, we're going to have to revive that, but let's be very clear that we're not talking about violence. We're talking about preventing violence. We're talking about protecting the church, which we have a moral and religious right to do, and we are not talking about guns. We're talking about putting in place safety measures that will clearly undergird whatever security at those churches now that I know that is none, and also make people conscious that they are soft targets. This has been known by the administration for years, given the fact of what has continued to happen in the Middle East, how on an arbitrary basis, how extreme Islamic brothers and sisters, how they blow up the mosque. I mean, this is nothing new, but the administration under George Bush and under Obama has done nothing to protect the church, has done nothing to provide training, has done nothing to provide a brochure, has done nothing to provide anything. He just allow us to be sitting ducks. We will not be sitting ducks. We will protect our worshipers.
Yes, there is nothing new about attacking black churches, especially down south. And there's nothing new about these armed white supremacist groups either.
And the FBI and the ATF seem toothless and powerless to stop them. they are not committed in protecting us against the extremists, not from the extremist Muslims, but from the extremists right in our communities, right in the United States. We're being terrorized in the face of all of this, and we're getting no protection from the federal government.
You've had preliminary talks, I'm sure, with other reverends and congregations in South Carolina. What's their reaction?
Well, their reaction is the same as mine. They want to harden security around the church. They want to protect the parishioners. Now that the authorities have taken note to the fact that they are soft target, but this is, again, this is nothing new. The black church has been bombed, terrorized for 400 years. But if this would happen to a Jewish mosque, we'll see everybody so upset. But this is not happening to Jewish people. This is happening to black folk. And yet our president cannot fix his lips to say that this is a racial motivated crime visited only on black people on a barbaric level. And this young man need to be dealt with accordingly. And I have to say as a clergy that may God have mercy on his soul.
Reverend Anthony Evans of the National Black Church Initiative in Washington.
Baltimore, Maryland is a predominantly black city with a largely black government, but that doesn't mean much to the city's poor population. Andre Powell is an organizer with the People's Power Assembly, which has worked closely with residents of the Winchester and Sandtown neighborhoods that were the center of protest over the police killing of Freddie Gray. Powell says poor people in Baltimore are standing up for themselves.
I'm encouraged by the people in the Sandtown Winchester community, and I think it will be a boost to them, and it has opened their eyes to the role of the state, and also that other people are seeing there are certainly needs. Now everyone wants to pay attention to it, but it's not something that happened overnight. This has been growing for several decades. And Sandtown Winchester is not the only neighborhood that's like that in Baltimore City, it must be said. There are neighborhoods like that in East Baltimore and South Baltimore and Southwest Baltimore that are just as poor and economically devastated and all occupied by the police presence under the guise of trying to stop the war on drugs. The war on drugs has become a war on poor people, particularly in the African-American community here in Baltimore City.
Yes, in a city that has long had a political class, a black political class, that at times controls City Hall.
So to speak. We know that the politicians are only part of the wheels and deals that are made in controlling Baltimore cities. The big financial boards like the Greater Baltimore Committee, whose representatives are filled with bankers and heads of corporations, the Chamber of Commerce, those are the folks that sit down and really decide what's going to be done, what can be done in Baltimore City. And the politicians, even though right now, the mayor and city council president and comptroller are all African American. It's still a matter of who, you know, when a city goes to get loans, who approves the loans? A bank does it somewhere. So it's not just the politicians decide, no, let's do this and let's do that. The banks and corporations have so much control over the destination of any city. You only have to look at the city of Detroit. That is a few years ago went into bankruptcy, and what the banks did and the austerity measures the banks told the city of Detroit, this is what you have to do if you want to get loans to try to build your city back.
That was Andre Powell of the People's Power Assembly.
The Ujima People's Progress Party is working hard to break the Democratic Party's chokehold on black electoral politics. Dr. Kenneth Morgan is with the Urban Studies Program at Coppin State University and works closely with the People's Progress Party. He says the party's trying to expand its reach beyond Baltimore to places like Maryland's Eastern Shore.
Denton's in Caroline County, which is the poorest county in Maryland. There are 23 counties in Maryland. And oftentimes, for example, the Eastern Shore is looked at as a plantation. Basically, the effort is to look at the entire state, because we know the struggles of persons in Denton, or the persons in Cambridge and other places, or Prince George's County, for example, of working folks are the same. So we're talking about economic oppression, we're talking about racism, and all the kinds of resultants that these things bring. You know, it's not what you can do for me kind of thing, it's what we can do together. UJIMA stands for collective responsibility. And so that's what we're trying to promote. And right now, we're building for a critical mass. We know that it's going to take much more than putting the right person in office, quite frankly. And it's slow, arduous, and difficult to do this because many of us are ingrained in either Democratic or Republican parties, the lesser of two evils. All of these kinds of concepts have been put in the way of building independent political parties. For example, Detroit, where Krieg, Reverend Krieg in the 60s ran as an independent candidate. That was truly independent. The National Black Independent Political Party, founded in 1980, made some attempts at this, but in my opinion, the split resulted from supporting Democrats, the Rainbow Coalition, and Harold Washington in Chicago. Bottom line is that electoral politics have to be put into perspective, and mobilizing and organizing the masses for struggle against the kinds of oppressions that we try to address in the platform come to fore.
The Eastern Shore of Maryland is, of course, home to Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman, and Baltimore has a solid black majority, and the state of Maryland, and most people don't know this, has the fourth largest black population in the whole country. So one would expect that Maryland would be a center of black political activity of all kinds.
And it is of many kinds. We have more black elected officials. For example, in Baltimore, we have a black mayor. We have the majority of our city council is black. We have, obviously, a number of black state legislators. So all these kinds of things. But part of the issue is that you often have to look past color. It's not all in black and white. And I think that's the message that we bring. And the oppressions and things that were exposed in Baltimore are mostly working class black people, which continue to be jobless. There are a few little remedial kinds of programs that have popped up, but it still doesn't really deal with the problems. And so our efforts are to actually to mobilize and organize a mass movement where electoral politics is a way to gain some platform to do that. And the things that you, the numbers, the statistics that you mentioned are part of those incentives to make this happen in Maryland. And we hope actually that once again, we help to rekindle a national movement. However, that is down the road. But I am sure that other people, other like-minded folks in other states are contemplating this, having some kind of independent political movement. I mean, for example, the last 6 years of President Obama, I think, helps to prove the point that you cannot look to a savior or a person in reference to changing the conditions that African Americans face in the United States of America.
Dr. Kenneth Morgan of the UJIMA People's Progress Party in Baltimore.
The deadline passed last week for Haitian migrant workers in the Dominican Republic to register with the government or face deportation. The cutoff date for people of Haitian descent who were born in the Dominican Republic passed back in February. Together, the two groups number far more than 500,000 people. Daoud Andre has some background on the humanitarian crisis.
It's more than a year since this process was started, and out of the hundreds of thousands of undocumented Haitians working in the Dominican Republic, living in the Dominican Republic, the process that the government set up over there was so difficult. It was set up so that people wouldn't be able to get through it. A grand total of 300 people were able to obtain documents. The government over there is saying that close to 200,000 people were able to start the registration process. First, they had said that they would not accept any more documents, that they would take a 45-day period to evaluate the documents that they got, and as of August 2015, they would start what they call mass deportations. Now, this is what they say. In fact, what's happened is since the 90s, you've had consistent deportations, sometimes more than others. And this year, 2015, so far for 2015, we understand we've seen numbers from 8,000 up to 40,000 Haitians who have already been deported to Haiti. And despite promises that the Dominican government made that they would not deport people with a registration ticket. This is like people who started the process. But in yesterday's New York Times, there is an article about a woman who was deported and was rounded up in a sweep on Monday, despite having her registration ticket, and deported to Haiti. This woman is in Haiti as we speak. So what's going on in the Dominican Republic, we've spoken about it before, it has to do with racism. Non-Haitian undocumented immigrants in the Dominican Republic, of which there are Chinese, there are Germans, there are Spaniards, these people, they're not worried. If the complexion of your skin does not look like an African, like a black Haitian, you have no need to worry, because the police will never stop you to ask you for documentation. But if you are black and you are from, I don't know, the United States, and you happen not to have your passport with you, you're at risk of being deported to Haiti.
So we're talking about two groups of people. One, Haitians who actually were born in Haiti and would be classified as migrant workers. And
exactly.
Then folks who live in the Dominican Republic who are of Haitian descent, who may have
who
never
seen... Who are born there, but of Haitian descent, yes. Like I said, the deadline to apply... They had categorized Group A people who had some kind of document at birth, and Group B is people who never had a document. And you have to understand that it's always been the decision, you know, of the hospital worker, the state employee at the local municipality when a parent would go to register their child. You know, they would look at the child or they would look at the parent and say, you know, we're not giving you a birth certificate for this child. So those people, they would fall into Group B, people who are claiming birth in the DR but never had a document, and people who, by the grace, I should say, of God, you know, or a state employee, got a birth document, they are Group A. The deadline for these people were in February, but both groups are subject to deportation to Haiti as of today, supposedly if they don't have a registration ticket for having started the process.
And in actuality, on the ground, the determining factor for whether you'll be stopped
is the color of your skin.
If with hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people coming under category A and B, and only 300 having completed the process, it would seem on its face that the process is not designed to be completed by many people.
Right. The 300 is from the group of immigrants, undocumented immigrants. This is neither A nor B. These are not people who have claimed birth in the DR. But also, in the group A and B, you have less than 8% of the people who applied who have gotten documents as well. And we're talking also hundreds of thousands of people. So the whole process, it was a joke. And we said so in May of 2014 when the president of the Dominican Republic, Danilo Medina, he came with this proposition law, which I have to tell you, both houses of Congress in the DR, lower and Senate, they voted this thing unanimously. And I have to tell you that the U.S. government as well, when we were screaming that this is a sham, this is not meant to work, this is meant to justify a mass exodus, mass deportations, mass, because if somebody's born there, we can't call it deportation, it's more like exile. The Secretary of State, then Kerry, John Kerry, he praised this law as a step, a solution to the problem that the court ruling of September 2013 that denationalized all of these people created.
In terms of the history of the legislature of the Dominican Republic, at one time, that legislature voted, I believe unanimously, a resolution that declared all Dominicans to be white.
Well, this is the farce of the story, and this is the myth of origin that Dominicans are Europeans, and at the worst case scenario, a mix of, they called it Indios, a mix of Spaniard and Indian, like, you know, like they had nothing to do with African blood. And this is the massacre that Rafael Trujillo ordered against Haitians in 1937, where close to 40,000 Haitians, we'll never know exactly how many, were killed. This was to cleanse the country, and then he facilitated, encouraged immigration from Spain of all kinds of criminals, whatever white he could get. He would welcome them, offer all kinds of advantages to them to come to the Dominican Republic, supposedly to whiten the country. So this is what's at the root of the problem. On one side, you have Haiti, an unequivocally black country, proudly black country. And on the other side, you have the Dominican Republic, a country of mostly black people as well. I would say maybe 80% or more black people, but people who are in denial, a lot of them who are claiming the opposite, I suppose, of what Rachel does. Well, they want to be white at any cost.
Yes, the Dominican Republic, of course, was born of slavery, just like Haiti.
Yeah, but the difference is that Spain never had nowhere near the number of Africans, and it was a sparsely populated colony. Spain did not invest much. They just came to plunder, you know, for the gold, whereas France plundered, but they created their plantation economy, sugar, coffee, all of this, and they brought enormous hundreds of thousands of Africans into the French side. But on the Spanish side, it was sparsely populated, but absolutely were slaves, enslaved Africans on the Spanish side as well. And the long relationship between the two countries, with Haiti, the Africans in rebellion having first with Toussaint Louverture, he taken over the entire island. The Constitution of Toussaint Louverture in 1801, it was a constitution meant to govern the entire island, because through the Treaty of Basel in 1795, Spain had ceded what's called the Spanish part to France as a result of battles that they lost. So when Toussaint was governor of Saint-Domingue, he had his constitution, 1801. It was for the entire island. And Dessalines as well, after independence in 1804, in the first constitution of Haiti, 1805, although the Haitian military did not have total control of the island, but that constitution, it claimed as part of Haiti, the entire island and small islets and offshore of the entire island. So a long 22-year period of Haitian occupation of the Dominican Republic, we can say 1821 to 43, where the Dominican Republic became an independent country. It was gained the independence from Haiti. A lot of people don't know that. And difficult relationship, but it's always been that the elite in the Dominican Republic has sided with the Europeans, that they would rather be slaves or a colony of Spain rather than to be associated with Haiti. But I should tell you that at many points, the first occupation of both Haiti and the Dominican Republic and the 1965 U.S. occupation as well, Haitians and Dominicans together fought against these occupations, fought against the United States. So it's up and down relationship.
In today's Dominican Republic economy, 85% of the migrant workers, we're told, are Haitians. How does the Dominican Republic contemplate operating its economy if it's going to treat its migrant workers this way?
It's just like the United States, from time to time threatening, you know, that they're going to throw out, expel, deport 12 million, they say, undocumented immigrants in the country. But of course, people understand that it would be very difficult for the economy of this country if the government were to effectively do that. It's the same in the Dominican Republic. But what happens when they do this is it keeps the undocumented immigrant, both here and in the Dominican Republic, in a perpetual state of fear, in a perpetual precarious situation where they are able to be paid maybe one third as what a Dominican is getting paid for a full day's work, where whatever injustice happens to them, they are not able to bring it to the authorities. So what happens a lot in the Dominican Republic is that on payday, like, you know, when the month is up for people to get their pay, some unscrupulous employers, they would just call immigration. And what they do, so as one group is being deported, these same employers, they send people in Haiti, in rural areas of Haiti, to recruit people to come. And they pay border guards, Dominican border guards, and high-ups in the immigration of the Dominican Republic to allow these people, these Haitian workers, to come in, and it's a cycle. They get rid of them. As you see, they are threatening to deport hundreds of thousands. Don't be surprised that at the same time, they are bringing in other Haitian workers to replace some of these people. So it's two things that is a problem for the Dominican Republic right now in what it's trying to do. It wants to have a white country. It wants to, and especially we're at an electoral period in the Dominican Republic, and the president has said, you know, he's going to deal once and for all with this Haitian problem, as if all of the problems of the economy is due to Haitian siphoning resources, which is false. But they need these workers, and also the fact, you know, the international pressure, the international eye looking at the apartheid, you know, the situation over there, because everybody who sees this can see clearly that this is something aimed at black people.
Yes, and the Dominican Republic has come in for lots of criticism, but Haitians catch hell all over the Caribbean and beyond.
There's a famous Haitian singer, deceased Haitian singer, and imagine, this is in the 70s that he made this song, I think early 80s, where it's saying that everywhere we go, we're in danger. And it's the reality of Haitians today in the Bahamas, in the Turks and Caicos. The same situation, lack of a birthright that we're speaking about in the Dominican Republic, that is becoming a law in the Dominican Republic. Well, in the Bahamas, it's been the state of things for many years, where children of Haitians are not allowed to be a Bahamian citizen until they are 18. This is when they are allowed to apply for citizenship. And this application process in the Bahamas, it takes up to 5-10 years. And if a Haitian immigrant has a child that's born there, the child is given a residency status. And if that parent is deported, the child is deported along with the parent. And what you find is that some children born in the Bahamas from Haiti or from some other country are applying for citizenship to the Bahamas when they reach 18. And in the Turks and Caicos, I have to tell you, so many incidents where the British Navy, because this is British protectorate colony, they ram the small boats of the Haitians, and every couple of months you hear of hundreds of Haitian boat people trying to get to the Turks and Caicos who perish at sea. And then the government in the Caicos says, you know, that it was a problem with the boat. But witnesses, survivors of these incidents, they testify that indeed it was the British Navy there patrolling the waters off of Caicos that sunk their little ships.
And what has the position of the United States government been?
Like I said, the United States is not a country that in itself is welcoming to all kinds of immigrants, you know, just as the Dominican Republic and these other countries, it favors certain immigrants, you know. But when this court ruling first happened in September of 2013, with mass outcry around the world against it, the government of the United States pressured, they said, you know, publicly that this is not right and that the Dominican Republic should find a solution to the problem. Like I said, when the Dominican government came up with the law that's being enacted right now that created this crisis we're dealing with today, the U.S. government praised it. You see, and we said it was a sham. And from September 2013, groups that we have been associated with, we have called for a boycott against the Dominican Republic, against Dominican tourism, against Dominican goods and products and services. And we, a couple of months ago, the New York State Assembly passed a law, a resolution basically calling on the Dominican Republic to extend the time period of this law. We criticized this resolution because we said extending it to 3 months will not solve the problem. One thing we haven't talked about, Glenn, is the role of the Haitian government. The Haitian government, which is a subservient government to the United States, to the elite in the Dominican Republic as well, that took the international pressure off of the Dominican Republic at a time when CARICOM, for example, was calling for isolation of Dominican Republic. It was Martelly, the clown Haitian, imposed Haitian president, who came and said, you know, no, we're going to deal with this in a bilateral manner, a government to government. And that's what the Dominican Republic wanted. And today, the clown, imagine the crisis we're in today, and he was winding his waist last Friday at SOBs in Manhattan, the supposed president of Haiti, singing and cursing. This is last week, Friday, you understand? Oblivious to the suffering of the Haitian people, oblivious to this kind of crisis. So the Haitian people in the Dominican Republic, they have no defense other than themselves and the well-meaning people around the world who are protesting. There were protests, different parts of the diaspora. In Miami, there was a group out. In Canada, a couple of weeks ago, you had a group out there, protests continuously in New York. And like I said, for us, we want to encourage people to boycott the Dominican Republic, because the Dominican Republic, it's the biggest tourist destination in the Caribbean. And this is what they are most sensitive to. And if they see planes are going empty to the Dominican Republic, they will understand that the world rejects apartheid in the Dominican Republic, just as it rejected apartheid in South Africa.
So, vacation anywhere, but not there, the Dominican Republic.
Absolutely.
Haitian immigrants and Dominicans of Haitian descent don't just have to face being hassled and deported by the state. There's also been a wave of civilian violence against them.
Absolutely, Glenn. There has always been mob violence against the Haitians and Dominicans of Haitian descent in the Dominican Republic. But these past couple of years, since 2013, since the court ruling that denationalized the Dominicans of Haitian descent, it's unprecedented, the rise in violence. We have seen burnings of houses of people, killings of people. There was a lynching in a public park in Santiago, the second largest city in the Dominican Republic, of a Haitian young man, Henri-Claude Jean. And just yesterday, there were in Puerto Plata, you had the burning of 63 houses of Haitians and Dominicans that are saying, you know, they're not waiting. Mobs of Dominicans that are mostly paid for by some racist members of the elite who call themselves nationalists, saying that the Haitians have to go and the country has to be cleansed. And Haitians and Dominicans of Haitian descent right now are living in fear. And some reports we have, people who are not going out unless they absolutely have to. And there are lots of videos that people can see on YouTube of cases of beatings of pregnant women. And within the last week, the scenes in front of the Ministry of Interior, where thousands of Haitians have been trying to register, and some people are going to say, why are they, did they wait for the last minute to register? And I should explain. Before, the Dominican Republic said, if you did not have a passport, you did not have certain documents, you don't even show up. And they said, after today, they would not accept any new documents. So there are some people who applied for a passport from the Haitian government for 8 months, 10 months, and they still do not have this passport. So people just stopped going to register. But last week, the Dominican government announced, if you have a registration ticket, even if you don't have all of the paperwork, you can come in and register, and you will be spared the deportation. And so this is the reason that it's within the last week that the world is witnessing thousands of people. There are people who have slept 4 days in front of this Ministry of Interior to get this document. And on Monday, there was a brutal scene where Dominican police was using tear gas and beating people simply for being on the line. They said, you know, they were trying to put order on the line. And there's a video of a pregnant woman who is tear gassed, and just people are carrying her, and she fainted. We don't know what happened to her. But the violence, definitely, it's increased. And that's the thing that people most fear, is whether 10,000 people are deported or 100,000 people are deported, but the mob violence that has been increasing, will it stop? At what point will it get? will it be another 1937?
Violence instigated by the Dominican Republic's government signaling that these people are beyond the protection of the law.
Absolutely, and the fact that these people, Haitians, wherever we are, we have no government to speak for us.
That was Haitian community activist Daoud André speaking from New York City.
A United Nations report claims that the tiny East African country of Eritrea is guilty of systematic human rights violations, and that a huge proportion of the refugees fleeing to Europe come from that nation of only 6 million people. Eritrea says it's been targeted for destabilization because of its independent foreign policy and its determination to develop its own human and natural resources. And Eritrea maintains that many of those refugees that claim to be Eritrean are actually from Ethiopia, Somalia, Sudan, and other African countries. The Iranian news agency Press TV interviewed Thomas C. Mountain, who's lived in and reported from Eritrea since 2006, and Saba Gebre Georgis, an Eritrean living in Britain. Thomas C. Mountain speaks first, followed by Ms. Gebre Georgis.
First of all, the report the UN issued is a complete fabrication. It's written by people that have never been to Eritrea. We've got prominent, very well-respected human rights lawyers like Lloyd Lipset of Canada that have been to Eritrea twice, carried out a very credible investigation, and it completely disputes these conclusions that these UN bureaucrats that have never been to Eritrea. So there is a propaganda war being waged against Eritrea. Now, the question of national service is based upon the fact that Ethiopia's got the largest, best-equipped army in Africa, has continuously mounted raids across the border into Eritrea, and we have to keep our young people on the border in the trenches to defend our country. In 2000, Ethiopia invaded Eritrea, displaced 1.5 million of Eritreans, and lost everything in a scorched earth policy. And that could easily happen again if the Ethiopians think we're weak. And so, unfortunately, our children have been forced to remain in the trenches. And it's true. National service is very hard on our kids. And so, you know, they suffer it, and after a while, they get fed up and you know, we don't blame them. They want to go outside and make some money. The economy has been hammered by sanctions, official and unofficial, that have been forced upon us under very fraudulent conditions, by the United States. We know that the sanctions were passed, thanks to WikiLeaks, in 2009, not because Eritrea is allegedly supporting al-Shabaab. The Americans know that's not true, because they were trying to sabotage the startup of the Eritrean mining industry.
So, Thomas, this focus on subscriptions of young men being basically almost like prisoners in their own country for life, how valid is that argument? Because it's being trumpeted all over the Western media.
Yeah, national service is tough for a lot of our young people. But then it's not only soldiers at the front. Most of our school teachers are national service. Most of our health professionals, young health professionals, are in a national service. So national service is an ubiquitous to Eritrean life. Everyone has to participate in it, and unfortunately, some of our young people get stuck in a trench, or even if they're working, then this national service pay, as all pay in Eritrea, is very small because the economy is so weak. So, you know, it's there, again, there's a lot of slander, there's a lot of exaggeration, but I'm not going to underplay the fact that national service is tough,
right,
and that the salaries are small, and young people are looking to get more money. That's why they're going outside. This is economic migration. And
okay,
is it
economic migration, Saba, that has been exacerbated by the government desperately trying to keep its young, most vibrant population within the country? Is that really what's happening?
Well, for any country, let alone Eritrea, a young country, vibrant, strong and productive human capital is essential. And youth constitute the most productive sector of the society.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Eritrea needs its young people to rebuild the country for future generations, to become a viable economy.
And do you buy the argument that the vast number of people leaving are Eritreans? Isn't there a bit of mixing up with Somalis and Ethiopians too?
I don't. I mean, UNHCR and European countries have a preferential treatment for Eritreans. Until recently here in the UK, if you claim to be an Eritrean, you would qualify for a refugee status straight away, and that's true in so many European countries as well. And so this has resulted in the Eritrean identity becoming the most sought-after identity among the Horn of Africa population, including Ethiopians, mm-hmm. including Somalians, including Sudanese, in some instances including even West Africans. So the fact is the draining of Eritrea's human capital is a part in part of the efforts that have been done in order to debilitate this country, in order to skim off its cream, in order to yeah. destroy its defensive and its productive capacity. Everything is part of a bigger picture, and that's just reverse the freedom and the sovereignty of Eritrea that's been achieved through sacrifice of mm-hmm. so many Eritreans.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.